Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Next question. How would you recommend responding to friends slash family that follow gut health and hormone health and fasting according to the moon gurus? I mean, I assume that you like these people, right? Like, if so, I probably wouldn't respond. I'm not just making a joke of this. It's really that if you value your relationship with these people, the idea that you would challenge their belief system, it's not going to benefit them unless they ask you to engage in the conversation. And what they would lead with is, what do you think about this? Or is this legit? Or is this something I should be doing? In which case they are asking for your expertise to weigh in on this. It's kind of like offering fitness advice in the gym to somebody who hasn't asked you, right? You see somebody lifting and you're like, well, I know a lot about this. I'll go tell them what to do if they didn't ask you. Generally poorly received. Usually they will not act on your suggestions, and usually you're invading their sort of personal space by doing so. And I kind of view this the same, unless somebody asks you your specific opinion. And in that particular case, I usually would start that conversation with, tell me what you know about this, and sort of let them go. Because you're trying to assess, what is their level of understanding, right? What is their fund of knowledge? Are they really, really into this? Is it part of their persona, so to speak? And that's going to help guide you on, you know, how you'd want to interact. But in general, I mean, this happens all the time to me. I have a lot of friends that are in this sort of space, and we usually just don't talk about it. If they ask me about it, I'm willing to, you know, opine on that or give my commentary, but that's only if they ask. I don't interject with my opinion. But if they do, and we kind of go down that path, I ask them what they know about it, what do they understand about it, why do they believe this, usually start asking for how confident they are in this, what sort of evidence have they seen or personally reviewed, and eventually you get to a point where, yeah, I just saw this thing on Instagram, and it seemed like it might be probable, so I started doing it, and I felt better, and so I am continuing to go on. And I, in general, have little issue with people engaging in these, I'll call them like placebo-mediated sort of activities, if the stakes are low, meaning that it's unlikely to cause them or someone around them harm, right? If the stakes are rather high, and we're going to get canceled for this probably, regarding like vaccination or, you know, particularly dietary habits or avoiding medications, things of that nature, I feel more strongly about being a little more stern and direct with my sort of take on things. But if it's relatively harmless, I, you know, go with God. I'm fine with that in general, because I don't want that smoke. I don't want our relationship to be compromised by having a disagreement that ultimately I care little about, doesn't affect me at all. That's just something that they're doing. Do you feel similarly about that?
Yeah, I think I feel similarly overall. This question really just gets down to, where do people's beliefs come from, right? And what is the process of belief change? And this is something that I've talked about in some previous Q&As and podcasts, and made a very particular recommendation on this for anybody interested in where do beliefs come from and how do they change. Great book called How Minds Change. I would recommend everybody read this book. Everybody. In addition to getting your blood pressure checked, you should read this book. It will make you a better human in how you interact with other people as it relates to their beliefs and how these things change and whether you should engage and how you should engage in belief change. And that would apply to this topic just as well.
Only additional comment I'll make on this is that, and this is something I struggle with and I'm working on trying to be better about, is trying to give people like the most charitable interpretation of what they're saying and where they're coming from, rather than thinking that somebody is just intentionally being, you know, obtuse or, you know, dumb or something like that, intellectually lazy, but rather trying to put the most positive spin I can on why they're saying what they're saying, why they're doing what they're doing. And I think, you know, sometimes you're wrong, but being charitable up front tends to, elicit a more positive or favorable sort of interaction than just, you know, pushing something completely away, telling people that they're not smart, or, you know, ultimately just telling them what to do rather than actually engaging in a conversation. I failed a lot of times. So yeah, working on getting better. All right, is there a reason for women accumulating body fat around the midsection during the perimenopause/menopause transition, or is this due to becoming more inactive in general? I'd also love to know more about dieting during menopause. It's always a hard conversation to have with the client when they are trying to lose or maintain body weight, but seem to trend upwards. Yeah, in general, I mean, the first part of the question is the increase in body fat, decrease in lean body mass, and is that due to inactivity? Or is it due to some sort of underlying change that occurs through menopause? It's mostly due to declining activity rates, overwhelmingly due to that. Yes, things change as people get older. We've alluded to some sort of structural changes to the level of the muscle. We've alluded to other sort of constraints on people's ability to participate in exercise and other sort of healthy behaviors. But in general, the biggest modifiable factor here tends to be the actual activity level. And so that's kind of where you're coming from. People will say, oh, my metabolism decreased, my metabolic rate decreased. And it looks like after adolescence, the metabolic rate in folks doesn't change until after the age of about 65 or so on average. And so it's not that your metabolism slowed down, the rest of you slowed down. And it's not a, you know, I'm not pointing the finger, I'm just saying that's likely what's happened. And we can try to do as much about that as possible. But I think, you know, explaining this is one part of the solution. I'd probably switch the conversation from an explanatory sort of standpoint to asking more questions. How has your activity level changed? Why has it changed? What sort of barriers do you have to from doing what you used to do to what you're doing now? And that'll sort of give you more actionable items rather than just trying to explain, yeah, here's the underlying physiology or underlying behavior that's been taking place. That's not, yeah, terribly useful compared to trying to find solutions, I think. And letting the person being a sort of manager in that process and giving you the information you need to help them out. But yeah, in general, due to decreasing activity levels, there are no perimenopause or menopause specific sort of exercise or dietary guidelines. They're the same. And so that should kind of clue you in on like specific changes that happen and how they don't tend to produce these unique sort of changes. Effectively, they don't. If anybody becomes inactive, you're going to see a decline in muscle function. Usually if individuals are younger and they become less active, they've built up or they have a higher physiological reserve. They have more muscle mass on hand. They tend to be more active in their day-to-day life. And so, yeah, it tends to be less noticeable. And then as people get a little bit older, it tends to be more noticeable. Do you have anything to add on the perimenopause?
Yeah, there's certainly some changes in terms of, you know, the main one being loss of estrogen, and that's thought to maybe contribute to some redistribution of body fat or changes in body fat distribution across the body. But I think I agree that most of it is due to changes in activity levels. And also by that point, people might be starting to, or sometimes have already accumulated a fair amount of medical conditions that might limit them in other ways from engaging in sufficient activity and things like that. But ultimately, none of this changes the conversation from what Jordan presented during the obesity lecture, where he talked about some of these biological factors of which, yeah, maybe there's a role here. There are some psychosocial factors. There are other things, and we want to attack all the ones that we can to set up the person for success in better regulating that appetite-satiety relationship so that they can spontaneously generate a calorie deficit. Whether that can be achieved exclusively through lifestyle interventions, that'd be great. But he also showed you guys the average success rates for intensive lifestyle intervention as it relates to weight loss, right? Not incredible. And so that means that what can we do? Do we just tell them, keep lifestyling harder? Do we say, well, you're postmenopausal, just not going to happen for you? No, this is something that we have the tools to deal with, right? We can intensify our intervention as hard as somebody can lifestyle, if it's not getting them to where they want to be, we have the tools. We have the technology,
yeah.
Right? Advancing to medical therapy, consideration of surgical therapy, if needed, very reasonable in this population.
You know, what's interesting is like, in general, younger populations will train like high level athletes or train in similar ways or similar frequencies, similar volumes. They're like, I'm going to lift all the weights. I'm going to do all the conditioning. I'm going to eat this health promoting dietary pattern. I'm going to try my best to jack my performance up to the highest level. Whereas the people who need it the most are older individuals. They should be the ones training like high level athletes. And so it's like you do it when you're younger because you can, but really the people who need it the most are aging individuals. So yeah, if you're listening to this, you somehow ended up on our YouTube channel or a podcast and you consider yourself an aging individual, as we all are, would try to train like your life depends on it, because it does. Oh, that was a good one. We're gonna clip that. Okay. How, if at all, do you adjust your practice of evidence-based medicine in the face of bias in research studies, including bias that you cannot simply detect through critical appraisal, such as cherry-picking of statistical techniques to achieve favorable publication outcomes? This is a great question. Effectively, it's like, how do you deal with the uncertainty you have about research? I feel like that's what the question boils down to, because we know that not only do the researchers have bias, the data itself, how it's presented, has bias. We as individuals have bias. Everybody has bias. There's bias everywhere. I think when you talk about things that would actually change what you do, change your practice, what you're looking for is overwhelming, converging lines of multiple different data sets that show the same sort of thing. And effectively, you feel more comfortable changing what you're doing or continuing what you do when you see multiple different data sets from multiple different populations, angles, et cetera, all showing similar things. You feel pretty confident that, like, okay, either I should do this or should continue to be doing this. One study doesn't really change what I'm doing in general, unless it happens to be very, very well designed and there's no previous actual evidence on a particular topic, in which case that can kind of clue you in on answering a clinical question that you had before. But yeah, in general, once multiple studies come out, again, all showing the same thing, you feel pretty confident, pretty comfortable that, yes, while everyone has some bias here, that it is unlikely that everyone has the same bias and would be showing the same thing. That makes me feel more comfortable about it, even though if people were to drill down on, like, how confident do you feel in this, I would hem and haw and talk out of both sides of my mouth for a while and ultimately say, well, we have to do something, we can't do nothing, and here's where I feel like the evidence is.
Yeah, the only thing I would add here, because I agree that having not just one study, but a large body of evidence is a way to increase our confidence the most, in particular a large body of well-designed studies that are at the lowest risk of bias. If I could answer every question that way, that'd be great. Unrealistic, never going to happen for a lot of questions. So the other things to consider is, what are the stakes at play, right? So if I have a condition that I'm looking at treating, and the treatment or not treating it, or the treatment that I have is potentially very toxic, very dangerous, high risk sort of scenario, I'm going to look for a pretty large and compelling body of evidence before I change my practice to adopt this thing, before I expose a patient to this risk or expose this patient to something that is not as well understood compared to the thing that is tried and true, right? So the higher the stakes, the more I'm looking for. If the stakes are very, very low, or if the proposed intervention, the proposed treatment, whatever the case is in the context of training, if the risk of trying this other thing is very, very low, then if I have a one study that looks decent, maybe I'll, like, you know, this is pretty safe, maybe I'll try it and start to get some of my own experience with this and see what happens, right? If it's something trivial, then I might try it even with a not super huge, not super compelling body of evidence and gain some of my own experience. But if it's higher risk, I'm looking for more stuff. That would be the only caveat I would add to that.
Sure.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health, or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
All right, next question. Are there quadriceps benefits to squatting at the margin of our comfort zone, even if we don't get the hip joint below the knee joint? So I assume this means if you're squatting above parallel, like, do the quadriceps have any benefit?
Like, if you do squats above parallel, is it worthless?
Oh, yeah, absolutely worthless. Internet, never squat above parallel. There's benefits to all muscles of the lower extremity from doing any type of loaded sort of exercise, in this case squats, to effectively any range of motion. As far as the magnitude of benefits and the specific type of benefits, that's going to be specific to the way you're testing it, so how you can evaluate that improvement, and also how you're training, right? So there may be some indication to do, like, quarter squats, half squats, other partial range of motion squats in sprinters, jumpers, or sports with a lot of jumping. That may actually be preferred in some cases. Not the only type of squat that they do, but certainly maybe some of the exposure. And for individuals who cannot otherwise achieve depth, as it's defined by powerlifting federations, the crease of the hip below the top of the knee joint, some squatting, any type of squatting, is better than no squatting. The real question then would become, all right, well, is it better to do a leg press with a full range of motion compared to a squat with a less than full range of motion, like something only due to the unique range of motion of the hip and the knee joint. And to that, I feel less confident. The squat itself, you know, there's some balance component there, does have an additional component that you have to deal with your body moving through space with a lot of degrees of freedom compared to the leg press. And so I think, again, it just depends how you're testing the sort of outcome, the benefit. So yeah, I think there's benefits to training the quadriceps at all different lengths. For most folks, I would in general recommend training through a rather large range of motion with a squat. If you can go below parallel, that would be my preference. If you can't, I think doing some squatting to as low as you can go is probably beneficial. For very specific athletic populations, I would, you know, reference your sport and see what are the specific joint angles that are apparent in your sport and train there as well. I just think like it'd be highly unlikely for an exercise that you perform to have no benefits. It may not have the most amount of benefits, but again, that just depends how you're assessing those benefits.
Yeah, a lot of these types of questions we tend to mentally divide into performance related considerations or outcomes like strength and hypertrophy and things like that, in which case what exercises you do and how you do them has a lot more importance versus health related outcomes, right? And in general, the general theme is as it relates to performance related outcomes, these details matter. As it relates to health related outcomes, well, where the stakes are arguably higher.
They are higher, but
these details matter less. What we mean by that is if we have somebody with diabetes and their hemoglobin A1C is 6.7%, whether they squat a centimeter above parallel or a centimeter below parallel is not going to impact their glycemic control and their A1C and their diabetes outcomes.
Irrelevant.
It's their blood pressure is 140 over 90 and they squat a centimeter above or a centimeter below, not going to make a difference. If they do, a 1/8 squat versus a full depth all the way to the bottom squat, then maybe there's, you know, some potential difference, but I still don't know that it's going to be massive, right? So for health related outcomes, I think that's why I even adjust the way that I coach on the platforms this weekend and in real life, depending on what do I know about this person? Why are they training? What are their goals? What are their preferences? What are their limitations? What are their resources? Those important questions that I hammered on repeatedly, because that's going to inform how much detail does this person need? How particular do we need to be about minor joint angle adjustments or minor range of motion adjustments, right? A lot of you guys who were on my platforms, you probably can identify yourselves of who was much more interested in very detailed, you know, nitpick coaching on certain minor aspects of the lifts, and others who I said, you know, that's perfectly acceptable. Are there things that I could have just hammered on you to make you look like a competitive lifter? Yes. Would you have hated me? Probably. Would I have hated myself? Probably. So we didn't do that. So there's differences in considerations based on the outcomes that you're looking at and who you're coaching.
Yeah. Can you imagine, though, if there was a study that came out, or a number of studies that showed that squatting below parallel definitively
cured high blood pressure?
Yeah, lowered resting blood pressure more than squatting above parallel. We would have a whole new line of business.
Yes.
Like, yeah, hey, look, yeah, we can help you.
We can get you there.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is our last question.
All right, last question. Would you ever, I like talking in absolutes, would
yes,
you
yes,
ever modify technique to prevent injury? For example, would you coach a swimmer who's pulling down with a straight arm to modify their technique to pulling back with a bent elbow for the purpose of preventing shoulder injury? This change may be advantageous from an efficiency standpoint, but would you consider it valid to make that adjustment for injury prevention alone? I think I'm gonna start with like a basic sort of analysis, and then you can talk about the swimming thing, and then we'll probably come together at the end.
Sure.
I think this would vary based on the movement, and that it would have to have some sort of inherent risk at doing it outside of this realm of acceptable technique, right? And the risk would have to be so high and so sudden that I have to stop the person right now and have them fix it. I cannot think of many movements that fit that criteria, meaning that if you do it this wrong way outside of the acceptable realm, acceptable range of correct technique, would cause an injury right then and there, and it would be catastrophic and it would severely set you back. I can't think of many exercises like that, I haven't thought extensively about this. I'm just thinking about, I've been coaching for 15 years. I've coached thousands of people how to do squats, bench press, deadlifts, power clean, snatches, etc. And I'm like, you could do all of those things at the margins of what I would consider somewhat acceptable based on the points of performance that you've determined ahead of time, and live a full and complete life and be fine. Again, the human adaptive potential is higher than we don't know where it ends. And so I'm just trying to think about an actual movement that would, again, very suddenly and with very little exposure, cause an injury. And I think that's mostly related to the dose of what you're doing for most sort of movements. So let's say you were doing jumping off a box to the ground, depth jumps, I think. And the person was landing wrong outside of, again, this range of acceptable technique. It would only be a problem if the box was high. It wouldn't be a problem if they did it off this small sort of ledge. And so in that case, you're not really talking about technique in isolation. You're talking about technique and dose at that particular point. And so I think it's really difficult to come up with a scenario, this manufactured scenario, where the movement done just incorrectly with no consideration of dose is very, very risky and needs to be corrected automatically.
Anything on a dirt bike?
I mean, I've done everything wrong on a dirt bike, for sure.
Hence the numerous fractures and dislocations.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even then, because again, the rate of speed and that's all problematic. Again, you just slow down and you'll be fine. Well, so that's the thing, right? The intensity of the dose is the problem at that particular point. Yeah. Can you think of a movement example that's like...
I struggled with this as well. In this particular example, the idea of a swimmer pulling down with a straight arm, if you saw somebody, or even if a seasoned coach saw somebody doing this, they're not going to be like, oh my God, that's so bad.
Stop.
Yeah. Right there. Rather, it's like, if this person has never swum before and they start swimming that way and they go out and they do 10,000 meters in their first session, dosage. Yeah. You're going to feel bad probably no matter how you move your arm through the water in that situation, right? And so, I mean, I remember swimming with a lot of people who had some very interesting, unique swimming technique. Even at the highest level, when I was swimming at the collegiate level, I had a distant swimmer teammate who had a horrifically ugly stroke. He would have one side that looked pretty normal, and this other side had this heaving straight arm stroke that he would smash into the water, and it just was the odd one out of the pool compared with everyone else. Everybody's like, what is that that's happening there? But he was fast. Worked well for him. That was, at some point, he acquired that movement strategy when he was younger, and that was the way he moved, and he did quite well with it. And if anything, trying to fix him probably would have slowed him down at that point, right? I talked about this with somebody else here this weekend about, apparently Usain Bolt having a pretty significant leg length discrepancy, and that has an impact on his stride. Imagine trying to make his stride perfectly symmetrical. He'd get dead last. He wouldn't qualify for finals, yeah. Right? Well, he'd probably qualify for finals still, but he wouldn't win in that situation. That's how freaky he is.
I think this kind of goes back to the screening thing, right? So you want to catch something in a period where you can modify it to affect the outcome, right? And then the stakes have to be high enough where it matters, and it has to be common enough.
Yeah.
And I just, this goes into screening for exercise, screening for movement proficiency before someone squats. Oh, you got to make sure they have enough ankle mobility or, knee range of motion or hip range of motion before they actually squat. And it's like, well, that's specific to the squat. So how am I going to find out before they actually squat? And if they happen to squat wrong in a relatively sterile environment, like the gym, perhaps an assisted squat or a squat to a box or something like that, I can tell could they do this or not? Can I, fix this, make it more efficient or not? But I don't suspect any sort of catastrophic injury that I would likely expose them to without screening them beforehand. And so I just think about movement screens in general not being terribly helpful. And I think, hyper-focusing on technique from an injury risk perspective, independent of load consideration, is, not very useful. For example, on a soccer field, planting and cutting, right? So you're landing wrong, and cutting and, might twist and rupture your ACL. Okay, that's maybe one example of a movement that, if you could correct it, would reduce risk of injury. And the stakes are high and it happens in the short term, but I don't know that you can fix that, is what I'm getting at.
Something that happens on the order of milliseconds.
Yeah.
Retraining that is very difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Retraining that movement pattern, getting people stronger, that's a longer term process. And so what would you do differently in that case? You maybe would maybe emphasize strength training more.
Yeah. I mean, even thinking through everybody that I coached on the lifting platforms this weekend, all of the corrections that I offered or cues that I offered, overwhelmingly, when I saw something and I suggested a cue, it was for the purposes of movement efficiency right? To make this lift more likely to be successful, to allow it to be more efficient such that they could use more load with the same technique and perform better. And most of it was an experiment. I would often have an idea of, yeah, this is probably going to work better for this person, but I was always eliciting their feedback. I said, let's trial, give this a try, because I see how you're doing it now. You might have a long history doing it like this and be used to this. Let's try this. Let's see how it feels and how it looks. I'll observe my objective kind of perspective on it. I'll get their subjective feedback on it. And sometimes they're like, oh yeah, that's so much better. Let's stick with that. Other times they're like, not loving that. And I say, why? Tell me more. Tell me what's going on, what you're feeling. Yeah. Tell me about it. And sometimes we'll revert back to what I preferred less from a textbook version of the lift because that was more tolerable, more comfortable. Maybe they actually moved more confidently or better in some way with the technique but prior to the adjustment. And so this stuff is malleable. But none of these adjustments that I suggested was due to me seeing it and saying, I can't watch another rep of this. This person's going to die if they do this again or something like that.
I think I've come up with an artificial, like a situation that might fit this.
I gave you enough time to dabble enough. You came up with something.
The idea would be that somebody sets up in such a way where an accident is highly probable to occur. So sure. I first started at motocross. All right. So at the start of a motocross race, you have up to 40 riders on a gate, backwards falling gate. And then somebody in the middle of what's called the doghouse that none of the riders can see will stomp on a pedal and the gate will drop. Everybody rockets towards the first turn. Now, the starting technique that everyone uses is you're either in first or second gear and you're way forward on the bike. The idea is that as you release the clutch and give it a lot of gas, you don't want it to wheelie over backwards on you. So if somebody was sitting on the back of the seat, for example, and was like, this is fine, right? Yeah, they're going to flip, Excitebike style, right? So then I'm like, okay, well, what about swimming, for example? If somebody was just learning how to dive off the blocks and they thought they had to aim as close as possible to the edge of the pool, you would probably modify that.
Straight down.
If somebody came out of the squat rack and set up in such a way where they were like teeter-tottering about to fall, you're like, okay, let's adjust this immediately. Yep. So you're trying to prevent an accident. To the extent that you notice the signs before the accident occurs, it is modifiable. I would do all of those things, so I would modify technique for that. Sure. A suicide grip on a bench press, for example. Some people
that
do it.
That means when you're bench pressing and your thumb is not around the bar, but on the other side, so the bar is prone to roll out of your hand.
Would probably advocate against that. As a general rule. So there, I think to the extent that you can prevent things that are highly probable to cause an accident, that would be my technique modification for reducing the risk of injury.
I like it.
But if it's not an accident-inducing sort of technique in and of itself, rather the person can do a repetition in a way that's somewhat repeatable and meets the points of performance, I think it is highly probable that they're likely to adapt to that if the dosing is correct.
Yeah.
Outside of an accident situation, I don't know that I can make an artificial situation that works.
Yep.
You agree?
I agree. Well done.
We did it. Thank you guys so much for coming to our seminar. I appreciate it.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.